Welcome once again to our program, The Da Vinci Code Deciphered, or The Da Vinci Code Answered in very of its many multiple statements that are so erroneous concerning actual facts of history. And we know, of course, The Da Vinci Code claims to be a novel, such a popular novel read by so many people. But even in the beginning, it talks about it's been historically researched and authentically checked, so you can trust these wonderful statements that have been made. And we're trying to say that there just isn't any real basis for this attack, at least in my opinion, this attack on the Catholic faith that is a dagger aimed at the heart of Catholicism and even of Christianity. Because the conclusion all through and the statements all through the book say that Jesus really is not true God and true man, which is, of course, the great mystery of the Word made flesh, as John puts it into his biblical language, and as the church has put it, Jesus is true God and true man. So we're going to continue to talk about this very often subtle but very real attack upon the heart of the Catholic faith. My guest once again for this 15th in the series is Ron Eldred, who is teacher at John Paul II Catholic High in government, religion, and history, world history, and which includes a lot of religion, and American history. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus here at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar in Terre Haute, Indiana. Ron, welcome once again. And we've been talking about some of the details in the Da Vinci Code, where it so diverts from basic Christian values and, of course, revolutionizes, as the advertisement for the book and the movie said it was out to really question the fundamental understanding of Christianity through the centuries. So I think we're up to that point where we were talking about paganism, we got to that sort of the rite of Hieros Gamos that Dan Brown makes so much about in the novel, I really hesitate to call it a historical novel because it is so falsely historical. But let's talk, in so many places, let's talk about Hieros Gamos.
Before I address that question, let me give just a brief summary so we can put that question in context. What we had been doing in the last seven or eight sessions is addressing some questions that Carl Olson and Sandra Meisel had brought up in their book, The Da Vinci Hoax.
And who've really made a real study of the statements made in The Da Vinci Code, and they call it The Da Vinci Hoax.
And what they've done is identify five or six areas where most of these big mistakes are located. And I'll list them real quickly. That one of them was that Jesus Christ was not truly divine, but merely a good man raised to a deity by the Emperor Constantine in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea. And we finished discussing that. We refuted that, I think, fairly effectively. The second one, Jesus Christ came not to save the world from sin, but to restore the sacred feminine, and I might add goddess worship, which we, of course, have been discussing for the last four or five sessions. We'll be looking at that at least two or three more sessions. Because that's sort of the heart of the book, really, this whole idea of the goddess worship, the restoration of goddess worship. And
which the church suppressed.
Yes.
Over,
at least claimed by the book, anyway.
Right, claimed by the book.
Now, the three others I'll mention quickly, that Jesus Christ was married to Mary Magdalene and had children. And we're going to discuss that, of course, later. And then another, Jesus Christ appointed Mary Magdalene to head the Catholic Church instead of Peter, and we're going to discuss that and refute that. And then finally, that the Catholic Church has kept these and other so-called facts hidden through force and intimidation over the centuries. And that's the last thing we'll discuss in our series. Now, to address the question...
Well, I like your little summary there, because many people have heard a lot of things about the book, but they don't know what the basic fundamental statements, concluding statements are, that Jesus isn't God, and that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, and that he made Mary Magdalene the head of the church instead of Peter, and so forth. So I think it's good that you review that for us.
Well, now I'll address your question about the right of Hieros Gamos. When we were giving a summary of the Da Vinci Code early in the series, we related how Sophie once walked in on her grandfather, Saunier, engaging in a ritual sex act. And this caused an estrangement between the two. She and her grandfather had, for a number of years, had not had any close relationship because of that incident. Later we learned, though, that what she had seen was an ancient pagan religious ritual called Hieros Gamos, which Greek for sacred union or sacred marriage. Supposedly, this was a religious ritual by which a man and woman were made whole in the reuniting of the sacred masculine with the sacred feminine. Langdon, you might recall Robert Langdon, one of the hero of the book, tells Sophie that Christianity, quote, banished the sacred feminine from the temples of the world, end of quote. But her grandfather, Saunier, remember he was murdered, kept the ritual alive by preserving this rite in memory of the marriage between Jesus, who represents the sacred masculine, and Mary Magdalene, who represents the sacred feminine. Now we'll come back and refute that particular issue later. Now Langdon, he enlightened Sophie by assuring her that her grandfather was really a deeply religious man, and that the Catholic Church had murdered him to stamp out once and for all the idea of the connection between the feminine and the divine. Now, all this wouldn't matter if people reading the novel didn't believe this and many other anti-Catholic claims to be true. But unfortunately, many people do, including Catholics. This is a perfect example of G.K. Chesterton saying that those who believe in nothing will believe in anything.
All right. Can you tell us what is wrong about Brown's claim about the right of Hieros Gamos that Sophie walks in on and then causes this estrangement with her grandfather?
Well, Mark Shea and Edward Shree in The Da Vinci Deception, and we've quoted them several times, do a great job of refuting Brown's claims regarding the right of Hieros Gamos. And they have several things here that they say is wrong with it, and we'll go through these. They tell us that in the first place, that the right of Hieros Gamos is bogus. It's an invention of Margaret Starbird, one of Brown's so-called scholarly sources. We made reference to her, you know, earlier in our series as one of his main sources, along with people like Elaine Pagels and several others. They claim that there's no evidence of such a right ever existing in the ancient pagan world. Second, they point out that Brown contradicts himself when he insists that nobody thought Jesus, much less Mary Magdalene, was divine until AD 325. If this is so, then what is Jesus doing acting as the sacred masculine? Thirdly, the notion that the feminine has been banished from the Catholic Church is simply nonsense, given the immense role that the Blessed Virgin Mary plays in Catholic belief and practice. Moreover, many of the Church's other great saints are women. In fact, some of the greatest saints in the history of the Church have been women. They come to mind people like St. Catherine of Siena and St. Teresa of Avila, my favorite saint. St. Therese of Lisieux, and, of course, above all, Mary Magdalene herself.
And then, of course, we had add today with the recent canonization of St. Mother Theodore Guerin, founder of the Providence Sisters of St. Mary's of the Woods.
And there are other American saints. Elizabeth Ann Seton comes to mind. She's a great, great saint.
One of your favorite, Mother Cabrini.
Mother Cabrini, Francesca Cabrini. Yes, all American saints. All of them except Mother Seton were not born here in the United States, but they came here and lived, became citizens, and were certainly Americans. And then lastly, the claim that not only paganism has a place for sacred sex is simply false. Reminiscence of John Paul II's Theology of the Body, in some of Dietrich von Hildebrand's books, Shay and Shree remind us that Christian marriage is a sacramental union of a man and a woman that is consummated in the marital act. They say that it isn't far off the mark to call marriage the sacrament of sex. However, they state that the crucial difference between the pagan view of sexuality found in the Da Vinci Code and the Christian view is not that pagans think sex is sacred and Christians think it is dirty. Rather, the difference is that paganism as ever gets it backward by worshiping the creature rather than the creator. Saying that Jesus was about sex, as Brown implies, is getting it backward. In fact, sex is about Jesus, for he is the creator of sex. He is the eternal bridegroom in the great cosmic marriage with his bride, the church. Our earthly experience, I'll continue quoting here, our earthly experience of marriage is but a foreshadowing of the heavenly reality of our union with Christ. For the pagan, heaven is the shadow. The earthly experience of sex is the reality. Christian marriage insists on the privacy of the sexual act because it is our most powerful earthly experience of intimacy, and it images the intimacy of God's relationship with the soul. But for pagans, sex is made a public act before spectators because the participants are emptied of their individuality and made into icons through which worshipers ritually participate in an abstraction called the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine. Like so much else in paganism, this turns the natural order of things on its head. And then they conclude by saying, in marriage, they experience something of the love that exists between Jesus and his church, and they thereby complete one another in grace, end of quote. And a lot of that's sort of along the line of what John Paul said in his writings and his
Theology of the Body.
Theology of the Body. He actually delivered that over almost 200 Wednesday, I think, sermons that he gave off the balcony there almost every Wednesday for
And I believe it was George Weigel who said that it may take the church, meaning all of us, 10 years to be able to absorb the depth of what he gave us in his insights about the theology of the body and its sacredness.
Well, I had read some of Dietrich von Hildebrand's books on that subject, and his wife Alice has also written some books along that line. And I think he had a great deal of influence on Pope Pius XII and Casti Canubi. I believe that was the great encyclical and had to do with the marriage and what have you.
Okay.
And then, of course, I think John Paul, of course, and I think his thinking on the theology of the body.
Yeah, I think Dietrich von Hildebrand led that whole introduction into the trying to get away from the Manichaean idea that there's something wrong with the body, there's something wrong with sex. And it's hard for any of us, because sex is so misused down through history in prostitution, etc., it's hard not to think that basically it's a great gift. And heard one person say that sex is like fire. It can be a great servant in Christian marriage, or it can be one of the most destructive forces in the world, out of control. And that's why I think the church has always tried to say that there is sexual morality. That's the safeguards against the fire getting out and becoming destructive.
You know, Dan Brown even impedes the Judaism. This just came to mind. Tells us in the book, and also I'm not sure, I don't think they mentioned this in the movie, but it's in the book, that the Jews practice this kind of sacred sex in the temple, that the Holy of Holies, the curtain, you know, there's the holy room, and then there's the big giant curtain, and then there's that was torn, of course, you know, when Christ died, and then there's the Holy of Holies, the place in which they had kept the Ark of the Covenant until it disappeared in about 525 in the 6th century B.C. when the Babylonians conquered and destroyed the city and the temple. He tells us that they practiced ritual prostitution there.
In the Temple of Jerusalem?
Yes, and then in the Holy Room, or the Holy of Holies, where God was especially present, Yahweh, yeah. There was also the Shekinah, the idea, if I'm almost sure, this is kind of a little fuzzy in my mind, the idea of Shekinah, of course, Shekinah is God's presence, it's the idea of God's presence. For example, when the cloud by day and the fire by night that led the Israelites across the desert in different places, the Shekinah was present. And so the idea is, I guess, is that when the men would go to see these ritual prostitutes in the temple and, of course, pay for their services, they would be uniting the sacred feminine, you know, with the sacred masculine. And during that kind of thing, it almost becomes a kind of trying to find the God within oneself by meditation or by the martial arts or that kind of thing. You get the idea that from Brown in the Da Vinci Code that men could also realize this kind of union with God in the sex act. And so you unite the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine, or Yahweh and the Shekinah, the female side. To me, this is just as derogatory of the Jewish religion as it is of the Christian religion.
I think most Orthodox Jews would rise up and revolt.
Well, when I read that, I could hardly believe what I was reading. Because I've never heard that brought out in any of the discussions of the many books that have been written to refute the Da Vinci Code. And I was really surprised that somebody hadn't really raised hell to the rooftops, you know, over it.
Well, and wasn't one of the greatest attacks of Orthodox Judaism against the pagan practice of temple prostitution? I think it's even in the Book of Maccabees, where they're starting to get into this the pagan kind of worship, temple prostitution. And I can't quote it right offhand, but one of the great Maccabean leaders led the assault against this and said how this was profaning the very meaning of our contact with God.
Well, this kind of thing just shows how far Dan Brown and people like that will go to try to undermine various religions.
All right.
Traditional religions.
Why do you think the Da Vinci Code seems so obsessed with sex?
Well, if I were going to be sarcastic...
Well, don't be sarcastic. Just try to be realistic.
I would say that sex sells.
Oh.
I think that Brown has a much more fundamental reason, though, to emphasize sex so much in the novel, rather than, you know, just the prurient aspect of it and the idea of trying to sell books and, you know, that kind of thing. Again, I think Shea and Shree have hit the mark on this matter. Reminding us of the Hieros Gamos, they state that a major theme of the Da Vinci Code is the deification of sex.
A major theme. So that's pretty critical.
And that's why we chose to discuss this topic, because it is a major theme in the
book. Not just something passing.
Yes. In this regard, they remind us that pagans practice ritual sex to worship the creature. And they tell us that, quote, in essence, Brown is advocating the worship of sex. So instead of seeing our earthly experience of sex and gender as pointing to the cosmic truths about Christ, the bridegroom, and his bride, the church, or recognizing in our sexual nature a dim reflection of the masculine and feminine that find their roots in the very being of the Blessed Trinity, in whose image we are created, the Da Vinci Code gets it exactly backward. It portrays the whole Christian religion as the cover-up for a naughty little sexual affair between a dead rabbi and his girlfriend. The book then blows up the affair, this affair, to become the basis for an entirely new church founded on the sacred feminine, centering on a cult honoring that girlfriend. In other words, Brown's big idea is that we should worship sex, or more precisely, the sexes. Since we live in an era that is obsessed with sex, his version of the church has, for the moment, his become the latest of real Jesus.
I think you slipped there. His version of the church or his version of Christ?
His version of Christ.
Okay.
His version of Christ has, for the moment, become the latest real Jesus. End of quote.
Okay.
Well, regarding the commanding role that sex plays in the goddess culture, Philip Davis, and we've quoted Davis several times in his book, Goddess Unmasked, quote, sexuality itself serves as the divine energy behind the goddess cultures, embracing both natural fertility and human community. The goddess power emerges specifically from her female sexuality, as expressed in the explicit sexual symbolism in rituals of ancient times. By the same token, the suppression of women in Western culture was allegedly gone hand in hand with the suppression of sexuality itself. Thus, the return of the goddess is inextricably linked to the sexual revolution, the liberation of those innate creative forces, end of quote. And so apparently, Dan Brown wants to unleash these innate creative forces.
Okay, one of the requests that we make of students who come to John Paul Catholic High is that they make a promise that by the grace of God, because that's the only way any of us could do it, they will live a life of sexual abstinence until they come for the time for them to get married or to give themselves to God in the religious life. Or in the priesthood as a gift to God, one of the greatest gifts that God brings any person, the power to bring human life into the world. But it's so countercultural, and I've never heard it said was this Philip and his Philip Davis and the Goddess Unmasked said that the return of the goddess is absolutely connect to the sexual revolution. Well, everybody knows we went through a sexual revolution in the 60s and so forth, but I never heard it explained that so much emphasis on the goddess, which we have today, is part of that whole connection, because that was, in paganism, it was intimately connected. You couldn't have a pagan culture without some kind of sacred prostitution or divinizing the sexual act. And so I think that's a very good insight that I never even heard pointed out before. Well, if I may say, can we go on to what we've talked about? So many, many times, the word Gnosticism.
Before we do that, I'd like to say a word about radical feminism.
All right.
And women's liberation, because, won't go into this, in any detail, but just some thoughts came to mind as you were talking there. I think a lot of the radical feminism and women's liberation in the last, let's say, 20, 25, 30 years has a lot to do. One of the most important things of that is freeing women from any past restraints of sexual propriety. And when you read some of the women's literature, you see a lot of that. One of the reasons that I think contraception has become so important, because this is one of the main things that tends to free women from, at least, quote, we'll use the word quotations there, free women.
Sure.
From child, having a pregnancy.
Sure.
And having to have children and not having to be dependent upon men as much and things of that sort.
Well, and couldn't we also say that the whole abortion?
Yeah, I was just thinking, yes, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yes, abortion certainly. In fact, abortion is the most sacred thing of all. It's the thing that I don't think there's anything that's, and that's why it's so difficult to stop abortion, is because it has become a sacred thing.
And it's almost like a religious belief.
It is. It really is.
That's why, and I think that's why, in my opinion, it's so demonic. Taking truth, and turning it completely upside down, that a woman should have a right to kill her own child. It's so unnatural, and it's so against every instinct of a mother herself, and yet we've sort of canonized it. And some of the movements have said this is something we must defend at all cost, or somehow we're going to put women back again into slavery.
I've always felt that women were really the civilizing, the restraining force, in history.
Right.
And the more freedom that men had in that regard, what wasn't right. In fact, it was really bad. But the idea, you think that making sexuality freer for women will make them equal to men, is just absolutely ridiculous. And I think what's happened is it just simply destroys the family. It destroys any restraining something there ever was, any self-control or anything we ever had before. Is just simply disappearing.
The statement was made that if women were supposedly freed by the readability, the availability of abortion, it even freed men much more, because they don't have to have any responsibility. If I've fathered a child, then all I have to do is give you $300 and we'll get this taken care of.
Well, I've always kind of felt that this whole contraceptive abortion thing is a conspiracy of men to dupe women, and basically they fell for it to hook, line, and sinker.
And
unfortunately,
the women are certainly the ones who end up with all the problems and all the pain and all the suffering, physical, mental, spiritual, and psychological. Well, there was an old saying somewhere in the early writings that if a man is bad, a man is bad. If a woman is bad, civilization crumbles. And I think that's what you were trying to say earlier about the idea that a woman is sort of the guardian of morality.
Yeah, there's no progress when women become more like men, especially in sexual matters.
Oh, my. And that doesn't mean that men shouldn't be free in sexual matters.
No, we're not.
We're not justifying that
at
all.
The very opposite, really. They should be more like women, like women used to be.
Absolutely. Well, Ron, our time has run out, so may God bless you always and in always.
Oh,